What makes a monster? Is it the absence of humanity? Or something more fundamental, the absence of remorse? In Jeff Lindsay's groundbreaking psychological thriller, Darkly Dreaming Dexter, we meet perhaps literature's most likable serial killer, a blood spatter analyst who moonlights as a vigilante executioner. Since its publication in 2004, the book has captivated millions, inspiring the Emmy-winning Showtime series that ran for 8 seasons and fundamentally changing how we view anti-heroes in fiction. Stephen King called it a macabre work of art, while The New Yorker praised its wickedly playful voice. The book's cultural impact extends beyond entertainment. It sparked conversations about morality, justice, and whether we can ever truly know the person sitting beside us. Let's step into the mind of Dexter Morgan, where darkness wears a human mask, and discover why this particular monster has earned our strange affection. The most fascinating aspect of Dexter Morgan isn't just what he does, but how he understands himself. Dexter doesn't experience his homicidal urges as choices, but as the whisperings of what he calls his dark passenger, an entity that lives within him, guiding his murderous impulses. This separation allows Dexter to distance himself from his actions while simultaneously acknowledging them. "Killing makes me feel good," Dexter admits early on. It works the knots out of darling Dexter's dark schema. But unlike most killers, Dexter operates under a strict moral framework, the Code of Harry, named after his adoptive father. This code dictates that Dexter may only kill those who deserve it, murderers who have escaped justice. After dispatching Father Donovan, a priest who had molested and killed children, Dexter preserves a single drop of blood on a glass slide, a ritual he performs with each victim, building a collection of trophies that serve as physical memories. What makes Dexter's psychological landscape so compelling is his self-awareness about his emotional limitations. "Whatever made me the way I am left me hollow, unable to feel," he explains. He describes himself as an excellent actor, someone who has learned to mimic human emotions and connections without actually experiencing them. The only exception seems to be children, toward whom Dexter feels a genuine protective instinct, perhaps because he recognizes in them the vulnerability of his own lost childhood. This duality creates the central tension of Dexter's existence. He is simultaneously monster and vigilante, predator and protector, inhuman and all too human in his desire to belong. The dark passenger isn't just a metaphor for murderous impulses. It's Dexter's way of making sense of a self he doesn't fully understand or control. Through this framing, Lindsay invites us to consider uncomfortable questions. How much of our own darkness do we compartmentalize? What parts of ourselves do we refuse to acknowledge? Miami isn't just where the story happens, it's an essential character in Dexter's world. Lindsay portrays the city as a place of stark contrasts, where beauty and brutality exist side by side under the relentless Florida sun. "There's something strange about homicide scenes in Miami's bright sun," Dexter observes. "It makes grotesque killings look antiseptic, staged, like a new section of Disney World, Dahmerland." This unsettling juxtaposition becomes a recurring motif throughout the narrative, where palm trees and blood spatter create a uniquely Floridian crime scene aesthetic. The tropical paradise transforms into a calculated hunting ground where darkness lurks beneath postcard-perfect scenery. Art Deco buildings in South Beach cast long shadows that conceal sinister activities, while tourist-filled beaches provide perfect cover for predators of all kinds. Dexter navigates this landscape with the ease of a native, moving between his day job analyzing blood spatter patterns for the Miami-Dade Police Department and his nighttime pursuits. He takes his boat out on Biscayne Bay, waving cheerfully to neighbors who have no idea what he truly is, using the city's waterways as both escape route and disposal site. Miami's multicultural tapestry adds layers of complexity to every interaction, Cuban Spanish flows through crime scenes, and characters like Detective LaGuerta and Angel Batista bring their cultural backgrounds into the investigation. When LaGuerta interrogates a witness in rapid-fire Cuban Spanish, we see how Miami's diverse population shapes even the pursuit of justice. Little Havana's narrow streets, Coral Gables' manicured lawns, and Overtown's troubled corners each represent different facets of the city's personality and different hunting grounds for its predators. The city's weather patterns mirror the story's emotional landscape with devastating precision. Sudden tropical downpours create traffic chaos, with slowpokes and road ragers creating a dangerous mix. Like these unpredictable storms, violence erupts suddenly in Miami's seemingly placid surface. The subtropical heat creates a pressure cooker effect, intensifying emotions and driving characters to extremes. Hurricane seasons bring both literal and metaphorical storms, as characters struggle against forces beyond their control. By setting his story in this particular city, Lindsay creates a world where Dexter's double life seems almost plausible. In a place defined by appearances and hidden realities, where tourists see only beaches while locals navigate complex social ecosystems, who would notice one more person wearing a mask? The city's reputation for excess and reinvention provides perfect cover for someone living a double life. As Dexter puts it, "Maybe that's why I love Miami. It's a city that understands disguise, where everyone from drug lords to real estate developers maintains carefully crafted facades. The city's history of violence, from cocaine cowboys to modern gang warfare, makes Dexter's activities seem almost mundane in comparison. The atmospheric pressure of Miami's unique environment, its humidity, heat, diversity, and danger, creates a pressure cooker effect that drives the narrative forward while providing the perfect camouflage for its protagonist's dark pursuits. In this way, Miami becomes more than an accomplice." At the heart of Dexter's character lies the Code of Harry, the strict moral framework instilled by his adoptive father that channels his homicidal urges toward those who deserve to die. This code transforms what would otherwise be senseless violence into something resembling justice, albeit a vigilante version that operates outside the law. In flashbacks, we see how Harry Morgan, a respected police detective, discovered 14-year-old Dexter's disturbing tendencies after finding a grave full of animal bones. Rather than trying to cure Dexter, which Harry believed impossible, he chose instead to direct these urges. "It's going to make you want to kill," Harry explained. "You can't help that. You can't change that. But you can channel it, control it, choose what or who you kill." This pragmatic approach to Dexter's condition raises profound ethical questions. Is Harry complicit in creating a monster, or is he making the best of an impossible situation? The code demands meticulous research before killing, ensuring victims are truly guilty. It requires clean, efficient kills without unnecessary suffering. And perhaps most importantly, it demands discretion. Don't get caught. Not just for Dexter's protection, but to allow the killing to continue. The flashbacks to Harry's death reveal the complexity of their relationship. When Harry realizes a hospice nurse is deliberately overdosing him with morphine, he asks Dexter to stop her, effectively commissioning his first human kill. This moment represents both the ultimate trust between father and son and the ultimate corruption of parental guidance. Harry weaponizes Dexter's darkness while simultaneously giving him a framework for containing it. What makes the code so fascinating is how it allows Dexter to maintain a sense of moral superiority despite his actions. He sees himself as cleaning up society's messes, removing those who slip through the cracks of the justice system. "If I'm ever caught, they'll call me a sociopathic monster and execute me," he reflects. "If size 712, another murderer, is caught, they'll blame social forces and release him in 10 years, with money for a new suit and chainsaw." The code becomes Dexter's religion, with Harry as its prophet. It provides structure, purpose, and justification, everything a person needs to make sense of their existence. But as the novel progresses, we begin to wonder, is the code truly about justice, or is it merely an elaborate rationalization for satisfying uncontrollable urges? Perhaps Dexter's greatest achievement isn't his killing technique, but his ability to craft a convincing human persona. He describes himself as hollow, yet he has meticulously constructed an identity that passes for normal in everyday society. "I fake human contact very well," he boasts, having studied and replicated the behaviors that allow him to blend in. This performance extends to every aspect of his life. At work, he's the cheerful, slightly quirky blood spatter analyst who brings donuts to the office. In his personal life, he maintains a relationship with Rita, a woman traumatized by her abusive ex-husband. Rita's trauma has left her uninterested in physical intimacy, making her the perfect girlfriend for someone like Dexter who has no sexual desires. She wanted only masculine company, a sensitive, gentle man willing to wait indefinitely, he explains. Such men don't exist in Miami, but I could imitate those qualities perfectly. What makes Dexter's disguise particularly compelling is how it occasionally slips, revealing glimpses of genuine connection. Despite his insistence that he cares for no one, he shows authentic concern for his foster sister Deborah. When she's captured by the killer, Dexter experiences what appears to be genuine fear for her safety. Even more surprising is his attachment to Rita's children, Aster and Cody. "Though I wouldn't care if every human in the universe expired, except perhaps Deborah, children are different to me," he admits. These moments raise intriguing questions. Is Dexter truly as emotionless as he believes, or has he simply buried his capacity for connection so deeply that he no longer recognizes it? Is his disguise becoming real through practice? The novel suggests that identity itself might be a performance for everyone. Dexter just happens to be more conscious of his role-playing than most. The ultimate test of Dexter's disguise comes when he's forced to interact with someone who sees through it completely. When he finally meets the serial killer who's been leaving him messages, he encounters the first person who truly understands what he is. This recognition is simultaneously terrifying and liberating, challenging Dexter's carefully maintained boundaries between his public and private selves. The central mystery driving the novel is the identity of a new serial killer stalking Miami, one whose methodology is disturbingly familiar to Dexter. This killer targets prostitutes, dismembering their bodies with surgical precision and leaving them completely drained of blood. The lack of blood particularly fascinates Dexter, who recognizes it as the mark of someone with extraordinary self-control and purpose. As the killer continues his work, patterns emerge. The bodies are found in increasingly public locations, arranged with artistic intent. When one victim's parts are discovered in a hockey arena's goal net, Dexter realizes the killer is deliberately escalating, seeking attention. A small mirror placed in one victim's hand seems to be a specific message, but for whom? The investigation is complicated by police politics. Detective LaGuerta, whom Dexter describes as terrible at her job but got into homicide through politics and ass-kissing, focuses on a convenient suspect rather than following evidence. Meanwhile, Dexter's sister Deborah, stuck in vice but desperate to make detective, sees solving these murders as her ticket to advancement. What neither knows is that the killer has taken a special interest in Dexter himself. After the fifth murder, Dexter begins experiencing something unprecedented, dreams and visions that seem connected to the killer's activities. "I woke at 3:14 a.m., drenched in sweat and absolutely certain another murder was about to happen," he recounts. "Somewhere in the city, he was hunting, sliding through Miami like a shark around a reef." The game becomes personal when Dexter discovers someone has been in his apartment. Nothing is missing, but something has been added. A Barbie doll with its head removed and body parts neatly wrapped in the freezer, mimicking the killer's human victims. The message is unmistakable. The killer knows who Dexter is and what he does. This cat-and-mouse game escalates when Dexter begins actively hunting the killer, following a refrigerated truck through Miami streets. The hunter becomes the hunted and vice versa, in a deadly dance between two predators who recognize something of themselves in each other. The question becomes not just who will catch whom, but what will happen when they finally meet face to face. While Dexter dominates the narrative, the supporting characters reveal different facets of his world through their interactions with him. Each relationship requires Dexter to adjust his mask slightly, revealing the complexity of his performance. Deborah Morgan, Dexter's foster sister, represents his strongest human connection. A dedicated cop, desperate to live up to her father's legacy, she's the only person who genuinely cares about Dexter's welfare. Yet their relationship is built on partial knowledge. She knows something is different about her brother, but can't quite identify what. When she asks for his help with the investigation, saying, "Don't bullshit me, Dex. All you have to do half the time is see the body and you know who did it," she acknowledges his unusual insights without understanding their source. Rita and her children form Dexter's attempt at a normal family life. With Rita, Dexter maintains his boyfriend disguise, playing the role of patient, understanding partner. But with her children, we see glimpses of genuine connection. "I'd spent 18 months slowly winning their trust," he explains, showing more patience with them than with any adult. Their trauma from their abusive father creates a strange kinship with Dexter's own damaged psyche. At work, Dexter navigates various relationships with colleagues who see different versions of him. Vince Masuaka, whom Dexter describes as, "like me, seems to be pretending to be human," offers a mirror to Dexter's own performance. Camilla Figg, who always blushes around me, sees something attractive in him that he can't comprehend. Most dangerous is Sergeant Doakes, the only person who seems instinctively suspicious of Dexter, saying, "he gives me the fucking creeps," showing remarkable insight for a police officer. Detective Lagerda represents another kind of threat when she develops a romantic interest in Dexter. Her attention forces him to adjust his performance, maintaining professional courtesy while avoiding encouragement. When she invites him to accompany her to a crime scene and compliments his day-old polyester bowling shirt with bright red dragons, Dexter realizes with horror that Lagerda was being social. "She liked me." These relationships create a complex web around Dexter, each requiring different aspects of his performance. The strain of maintaining these various masks creates moments where his true nature threatens to emerge, particularly when the refrigerated truck killer begins targeting people close to him. While Dexter's nighttime activities drive the plot, his daytime job as a blood spatter analyst provides both cover and insight. His professional expertise isn't just a convenient occupation, it's an extension of his fascination with blood and death, channeled into socially acceptable forms. Dexter approaches blood patterns with the same meticulous attention he brings to his kills. When analyzing a hotel room double homicide involving a chainsaw, he uses two bottles of expensive luminol and string techniques to determine the primary spatter angles. From these patterns, he deduces that the killer was right-handed, overweight, size 7.5 Italian loafers with a terrific backhand. This professional knowledge gives Dexter unique insights into the refrigerated truck killer's methodology. He immediately recognizes the significance of bloodless bodies, understanding that complete exsanguination requires specific techniques and extraordinary patience. When examining the victims, he notices subtle differences in cutting styles, some rough and emotional, others more controlled, that others mess. "He's experimenting," Dexter explains to a colleague, "trying to find the right way." Blood represents more than evidence to Dexter. It's almost a character in its own right. He preserves blood slides from his victims as trophies, creating a collection that serves as a physical record of his kills. When he impulsively murders Jamie Jaworski without collecting a blood slide, he feels the kill is incomplete. the kind of tiny, absurdly unimportant detail that turns strong men of action into fidgeting neurotics. The cold storage of bodies also fascinates Dexter, who appreciates how refrigeration preserves evidence by slowing decomposition. When Deborah asks about cell crystallization from cold, Dexter finds himself struggling to explain his appreciation. The cold had slowed the blood flow in the victim, something I found beautiful but could never explain to Deborah. This professional knowledge creates dramatic irony throughout the novel. Dexter uses his expertise to help catch killers while simultaneously applying it to avoid detection himself. His understanding of forensic techniques makes him both a valuable asset to law enforcement and a more dangerous predator. As he puts it, "I don't do my job to catch bad guys. I do it to make order out of chaos, to force nasty bloodstains to behave properly and then go away." The novel's most shocking revelation comes in its final chapters. The refrigerated truck killer is Dexter's biological brother, Brian. This discovery forces Dexter to confront the origins of his own darkness and raises profound questions about nature versus nurture in the creation of monsters. Brian explains that as young children, they witnessed their mother's murder by drug dealers who dismembered her with a chainsaw. "You were 3 years old, I was 4," he tells Dexter matter-of-factly. The brothers were left sitting in an inch of dried blood for 2.5 days before being discovered, a traumatic event that shaped them both irrevocably. The brothers were separated after their rescue. Dexter, considered young enough to recover, was adopted by Harry Morgan. Brian, slightly older, was institutionalized. "They thought you were young enough to recover. I was just a bit over the age limit," Brian explains. "It made me what I am, and I had a thought that it might do the same for you." Dexter's response, "It did, exactly the same," confirms their shared psychological damage. This revelation recontextualizes everything we know about Dexter. His dark passenger isn't just a metaphor for murderous impulses. It's the psychological manifestation of childhood trauma so severe his conscious mind has blocked it entirely. Harry's code wasn't just about channeling natural urges. It was a desperate attempt to give structure to a damaged psyche. The brothers' reunion creates the novel's central moral crisis. Brian has kidnapped Deborah, intending her to be their first joint kill, a twisted bonding ritual between long-lost siblings. This forces Dexter to choose between his biological brother, who truly understands him, and his adoptive sister, who has always cared for him despite not knowing his true nature. The parallels between the brothers are striking. Both kill methodically, both preserve bloodless bodies, both maintain careful public personas. Yet their different upbringings created crucial differences. Harry's code gave Dexter rules and purpose. Brian kills indiscriminately. This nature versus nurture question becomes the novel's philosophical core. Are monsters born or made? Can trauma explain evil without excusing it? And most importantly, can someone like Dexter ever truly choose connection over darkness? As the novel reaches its conclusion, Dexter faces an impossible choice between his biological brother, who shares his darkness, and his adoptive sister, who represents his tenuous connection to humanity. This dilemma crystallizes the book's central theme, the duality that exists within all of us, but which Dexter experiences in its most extreme form. Throughout the story, Dexter has maintained that he is fundamentally different from other humans, hollow, emotionless, driven by urges he can control but never eliminate. Yet his actions often contradict this self-assessment. He feels genuine concern for Rita's children. He risks his carefully constructed life to save Deborah. He maintains relationships and follows codes that suggest more humanity than he acknowledges. The novel's epilogue, set at a police funeral, captures this contradiction perfectly. Dexter playfully sighs, "Ah, Deborah," as if mourning, only to be elbowed by his very much alive sister. She has survived and been promoted to sergeant for her work identifying the Temyami slasher. Though an APB is out for Brian, Dexter admits, "Despite everything, I hope he stays free. Family is important after all. This final reflection encapsulates Dexter's complex moral landscape. He has chosen Deborah over Brian, humanity over monstrosity, yet still feels kinship with his murderous brother. He operates according to a twisted moral code that somehow coexists with genuine affection. He is simultaneously monster and human, predator and protector. Lindsay leaves us with the suggestion that Dexter's duality might not be so different from our own, just more extreme. We all contain darkness and light, selfish impulses and capacity for connection. We all wear masks and play roles depending on our audience. We all struggle to reconcile our private thoughts with our public actions. Perhaps what makes Dexter so compelling and disturbing is not how different he is from us, but how familiar his struggles sometimes feel. His extreme compartmentalization reflects our own tendencies to separate parts of ourselves we don't wish to acknowledge. His careful performance of normalcy echoes our own social adaptations. His search for meaning and connection despite his limitations mirrors universal human longing. In creating a protagonist who is simultaneously repulsive and sympathetic, Lindsay invites us to examine the boundaries of our own humanity. If we can understand, even root for, someone like Dexter, what does that reveal about the darkness within ourselves? And if Dexter can find moments of genuine connection despite his limitations, what hope might that offer for all of us struggling with our own inner demons?